sermons began with the nursery rhyme, "Old Mother Hubbard." I'm sure you remember, in fact, if you stayed along with me, "Old Mother Hubbard went to the cupboard to give her poor doggy a bone. But when she got there, the cupboard was bare, and so the poor dog had none." It's pretty good for teaching the worship. The church's cupboards were bare, my dad would suggest, and even replenishing. I don't think he meant the church was bare on resources, or rather, that we had the resources we needed, including financial ones, if only we could acknowledge that and reframe and recalibrate our understanding. But we're asking, even now, to give from our scarcity. Only enough to barely fill the cupboards, if at all, or do we give from our abundance so that the cupboards are overflowing? As we are just getting to know each other, I will tell you that one of my go-to scholars is the Old Testament theologian Walter Brueggemann. And that I've heard Brueggemann's name mentioned from this pulpit. Brueggemann connects the vision of the Old Testament with the church's call in the world today, and he writes with extraordinary skill and passion. 20 years ago, Brueggemann published an essay that still resonates: "The Liturgy of Abundance, the Myth of Scarcity." The Liturgy of Abundance, the Myth of Scarcity. Brueggemann began where we should with the Bible. The Bible, he says, is a liturgy of abundance, a song of praise for God's generosity. Our calling is to embrace and celebrate God's abundance, to nurture and to care for it. That's our imperative, the liturgy of abundance, to celebrate God's generosity. Of course, there's a counter-narrative, biblically, and present in our current moment. Brueggemann calls it the myth of scarcity. Brueggemann writes that as we Americans grow more and more wealthy, money is becoming a kind of narcotic for us. We hardly notice our own prosperity or the poverty of so many others. The great contradiction is that we have more and more money and less generosity. It goes on to say we never feel that we have enough. We have to have more and more. And this insatiable desire destroys us. The central problem of our lives is that we are torn apart by the conflict, he says, the conflict between our attraction to the good news of God's abundance and the power of our belief in scarcity. We spend our lives trying to sort out that ambiguity. So he summarizes by saying this: the conflict between the narratives of abundance and of scarcity is the defining problem confronting us. That was 2 years ago. Brueggemann explores biblical moment after biblical moment of abundance and of scarcity. Some of them are about money, but not all of them. Sometimes it's food or justice or power. But money is a regular biblical focus. That's what Jesus said succinctly: you cannot serve God and wealth. Now we can explore what that looks like more fully. Every implication and consequence. So, as we heard, a letter to a younger follower named Timothy, attributed to Paul, we encounter the ethics of abundance and scarcity playing themselves out. Paul writes, "We brought nothing into the world so that we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with these." That is, we have enough. And yet, Some wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pains. Love is the root of all kinds of evil, even to the point of causing pain. Somebody tells us the problem. Loving it is. Loving it so much that it obscures faith and harms both those who have and those who do not. This is not hypothetical. I read this week about James Cowan, an orthopedic surgeon turned hedge fund manager who was caught and then imprisoned for several years for illegal trading practices. Coming out of prison, Cowan said that I had no idea, how deeply in love I could fall with making money. That was nothing compared to how deeply I was in love with myself, he said. I had no idea how deeply in love I could fall with making money. And not that we need a disgraced hedge fund manager to illustrate Paul's point, but that testimony makes this biblical concept very tangible, does it not? And then Paul follows up with a kind of a mission statement. I need to tell you, my first meeting here this week was with the stewardship committee. And these two lectionary texts feel like a kind of divinely orchestrated setup. But here goes, here's what Paul says. As for those who in the present age are rich, commanded them not to be haughty, or to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but rather on God, who richly provides us with everything. For our enjoyment. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, generous and ready to share, thus storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of the life that really is life. The problem for Paul, perhaps for us, is not money. It's not just clever parsing or wishful thinking. William Lloyd writes that Paul is not rebuked for rich, and then leave them with unreal choices to which their intelligence knows are wrong and from which they switch off, inoculated against future challenges. Rather, Paul speaks about using one's wealth effectively. But one thing more. Note that the stewardship Paul is commending to the rich and to all of us is not just about sharing our material wealth. We are called to do good, to be rich in good works. In case we're not sure exactly what that looks like, let's share a tease about this. Bearing this admonition from Paul with a searing parable from Jesus. The wealthy man eats and drinks, wears fabulous clothes, enjoys a good life. And down the road at the gate to his property is a poor, diseased man named Lazarus. No starker contrast can be imagined. They both die. The poor man goes to heaven, the rich man does not. Smoking or non-smoking, as a friend of mine says. The rich man begs for mercy from Abraham at heaven's gates. No mercy is offered. Abraham says, shall I remember that during your life you received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner evil things? He's comforted, now you are in agony. The rich man accepts his faith and with compassion asks, it's not for me, what about my brothers? They're still living, they can still be saved. Nobody has no mercy. It can sound harsh. It may be harsh. But more so, Jesus is clear about opportunity after opportunity the rich have had to work all of this out. He engaged the issues of heaven and hell, Faith invites us into a cycle, a rhythm, a kind of a symphony or a dance with three parts to it, three acts: abundance, gratitude, generosity. Abundance, gifts overflowing, every kind of gift, money and relationship and vocation and calling and climate energy, gifts overflowing given to us by a just and loving merciful God. Gratitude, our call, our invitation to acknowledge those gifts, to cherish and celebrate them, and most of all, to thank God for them. And generosity, to share those gifts, and to share them with joy. That's the cycle of our faith: abundance, gratitude, generosity. There's a competing cycle, a counter cycle to all of that. I articulated also what you can read in the Bible and in our present moment. Rather than celebrate abundance, we cling to scarcity. The notion that there is not enough, that the empty cupboard is an exception. Yeah.